is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
The Jubilee celebrating 70 years on the throne for Elizabeth II. What is the significance of the English crown, the British crown, in geopolitics over more than a century from Victoria to Elizabeth II? I welcome Gregory Copley, the editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs, who has published most recently a reflection on not only Elizabeth II's success as the Queen, 70 years, but also how this brings together the strength of the British crown and what it means to the people of Europe and the world. Gregory, a very good evening to you. You make the case that what we're looking at is a constitutional monarchy that represents something you can count on, something you can trust. Elizabeth II, what was her mission when she was crowned in 1952? How did she present herself to the English people, to the British people, and to the world? And how did she follow her mission? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Well, Queen Elizabeth, when she was when she became queen with the death of her father, she pledged to devote all of her life to the service of the country and of the Commonwealth, and that meant until she died. She took the actual coronation anointing, which is to be the, if you like, a religious obligation to serve with every fiber of her being, and that meant that she could not and would not ever relinquish the duty until she died, and she's certainly been true to that. Her goal, though, was not just to be the queen, because that's not the point. In fact, the point is to maintain a system which puts the unity of the country, and in this case the Commonwealth, above governance and above politics. And that's the whole point of constitutional monarchy, and that is to provide a symbolism and a value system for people which transcends politics, so that you don't elect a leader who is going to be of one political persuasion or another, and therefore polarizes the country. So what you generally have with a modern republic is a government which, and a president who, if you like, it represents the tyranny of the marginal majority over the marginal minority, because you just get polarized nations. And that's what we've seen increasingly in the past decades in Western Europe and in North America and so on. The polarization factor is profound. But what you want is for there to be continuity of identity, so that people identify themselves with the overall concept of being a Briton, for example, whether you're English or Scots or Welsh or Irish. You can identify with the overall grouping and the ethics of the which are portrayed by the crown. So, in a sense, the Queen understood that her role was not to be a charismatic personal leader in her own right, but rather to stabilize everything, to make sure that there was no element of personality dominating her reign, but rather she should bring together and reflect and represent values which could be seen to be durable, permanent, but durable over generations. And what we saw with the success of Britain after 1066 and the conquest was that as they came after two generations, three generations of the crown, they moved to a position of articulated primogeniture. In other words, it would always be the eldest son in those days of the monarch who succeeded as the next king. That also had the ability to bring in women, as we saw Elizabeth I, for example, as queen. And so that you get this continuity, though, that you don't have to reinvent government every time you have a new era, a new prime minister or a new leader, the fact is that the crown endures, and underneath that, what we've seen is that governments come and go, and they become more and more democratic or more answerable, if you like, to an electorate. But the reality is that the continuity of the state remains. You have much more harmony in discourse among people, even if they disagree on whether they're socialist or capitalist or conservative or left-leaning. So that's been the great strength. And Queen Elizabeth says, I think she's, yes, she's basked in the love, adulation and respect of people around the world and in Great Britain particularly. But I think she is somewhat concerned that people are paying too much attention to her and not enough to what she achieved in maintaining this system of neutrality and if you like, an iconic command of the attention of people. Now, the United States, we think of as a republic, and as it is, but the reality is that in order to have a sovereign-like or a crown-like image for Americans to support, they created the Constitution and imbued the Constitution and other symbols with the same mysticism that the British imbued the crown. And the more you detract from that mysticism of the Constitution or the crown, the more you open your debate up to temporal and transactional behavior. And that's what breaks up countries. So the Queen is anxious that the crown as an institution is preserved with the dignity and mysticism with which it's been imbued for over 1,000 years. And she's, I think, done that to a great extent. And so the thought among some of the more Republican-oriented members of the Commonwealth, like Australia, when I say Republican-oriented amongst the politicians, not amongst the population, they think, well, when Queen Elizabeth dies, we'll be able to say, okay, well, she was nice and she was wonderful and we wouldn't do anything while she was alive, but we can now dispense with the monarchy and go for an elected Republican head of state. Well, hang on a minute, is what most of the voters are going to say, particularly in Australia, where they were asked this question in 1999, and almost two-thirds of the population said, hey, the system ain't broke, so let's not fix it. We don't want an elected politician as the president or head of state, because that is divisive and short-term. We like the system as it is now because the Queen is above politics, and they, of course, made sure that it's the Queen of Australia, not the Queen of the United Kingdom, who they answer to. So we've got that situation now where we will see a lot of unrest and concern and fears from the people who adored the Queen, but now don't know what to do when she leaves the scene. The reality is that the Prince of Wales, Prince Charles, is likely to be a very, very good monarch. He's coming to the throne very late in life. He's 72, I think, now. So he's not going to be on the throne as long as Queen Elizabeth, his mother, but he will be there long enough to introduce some changes and stabilization of the monarchical system, just as King Edward VII did on the death of Queen Victoria. So I don't think we should despair for the crown as an institution. I think Prince of Wales will modernize it in the same way that Edward VII did after the death of Queen Victoria. And then Charles will pave the way for his son, William, to take over for presumably a very long reign.
In the spring of 1940, during the crisis with the German army rolling up the continent, I was struck by when Chamberlain decided to step away from being prime minister, and we know that Churchill then became the PM. The way it was presented is, the king will send for you, Winston. He did then offer the prime ministership to Winston, meaning it was not an act of division. It was an act of unity. That's how it was always striking to me, that Winston Churchill, a supreme politician, was then in a good position to say, the king asked for me, therefore your dissent is inappropriate, because we are one nation ruled by the kingship. Is that the way to read that, Gregory?
Well, yes, in some respects, that's correct, because there has to be harmony between the crown and the government. And generally there is. I mean, look at Queen Elizabeth, who presided over numerous governments of varying political persuasions. Right. And yet there was never any question as to whether she was partisan to one or another. And in fact, to this day, nobody is aware of whether she favored one government over another, or whether she's conservative or liberal. She's just there representing values which transcend politics. And the fact that when the king calls for someone to kiss hands and become prime minister, it's not necessarily based on the king's personal decision. It's based on the majorities in Parliament, for example, and so that Parliament throws up the candidates who are qualified to be a prime minister, and then having been asked by the king or the queen to form a government, that politician must then go about the business of building a sufficient consensus within the House of Commons to become effectively the prime minister, and then present his cabinet to the king to appoint the ministers.
We're going to leave the happy kingdom off the coast of France, Great Britain, and we're going to go to Australia next, because Gregory's just returned from there, and there's a new government in Canberra. There's a continuing crisis in this Indo-Pacific, and a story of Australia that is yet to be written about how it's going to deal with the aggression of the People's Republic of China. I'm John Batchelor.